the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, it's great to be back. I simply had to come back. You and Johnny did such a sterling job on last week's episode. I feared for my place.
Well, don't fear it at all. I'm much less nervous in this section, so I'm much happier that you're back. And yeah, I've got an all new appreciation of all the work that you do. Yeah, it's a lot goes into doing these that I maybe didn't really realise. So I'm very delighted you're back, but I'm glad you enjoyed the episode.
Yes, it was a tremendous listen, although my son did question the lack of bad Pikachu jokes. So I'm back with maybe some more of those on this episode. And we'll see how we go as things pan out along the way. But basically back into the swing of things from today, Monday, back at work after a long summer break. So, the J-Talk podcast, the big pod, is ready to roar through the rest of the J1 season. But leading us off on this week's episode is a look back at Urawa Reds' simply epic journey to the Asian Champions League final. We'll be talking about that with a first-time guest, and then Sam and I will review the six games from J1 Match Day 27 played over the weekend. So after a quick hit of music, we'll welcome in our guest. And joining us to talk about that epic game at Saitama Stadium last Thursday night, another ACL classic for Urawa Reds, is a first-time guest to the podcast and a Saitama Stadium regular. It's Ralph Seidel. Ralph, welcome to J-Talk. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be on the show.
As I say, great to have you with us. And I should just let all the listeners know, long-term listeners and regular listeners are familiar with our content. They know that Ryan Steele is usually our Urawa correspondent. But for a game like last Thursday, we simply had to go right to the source and somebody who was there at the game. By the way, I have cleared this with Ryan and he's okay with it. He's very much looking forward to listening to what Ralph's got to say about. As I say, Ralph, just another epic ACL night for your club. It's you've made a very happy habit of it in recent years, of course, winning the ACL for the second time in 2017 and making it all the way to the final in 2019. It's become a part of the fabric of the club, and what a special occasion it must have been for you to be there.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. This whole campaign, finally being able to sing again, and these three ACL games, they were absolutely amazing. And it was really great to see this energy, see how we really again in the last minutes actually managed to get into the penalty shooting and so on. So that was quite amazing to watch again.
And sorry, Ralph, I've got a little bit ahead of myself here top of this part of the podcast. Usually with first-time guests, we do ask them to give us a little bit of your backstory, where you're from, how you became interested in Japanese football, and in your case, how you made it to Japan.
Okay. So I've been living now already, I think, 12 years uninterruptedly, and overall more than, I think, 15 years or so in Japan. I'm originally from Germany and still also a happy supporter, not so happy, we're in the second division of Nuremberg in Germany as well. And I've been in Japan now for quite a long time, and not the whole time I was watching the J-League. So that came actually a little bit later, and mostly thanks to other families with children in the same age of my son, where one actually owned at that time still an izakaya nearby, and people usually got there for the away games. And he was a big supporter, and he brought me basically then to the club. And since then, I've been going more and more regularly, and have now for, I think, 50 or so also a season ticket to Urawa.
Okay, that's absolutely brilliant. And you've lived a number of these exciting nights in the ACL than in recent years. And well, Sam, you talked with Johnny about this East final, this ACL semi-final on last week's episode, and you both said that you didn't expect it would be as easy, obviously, as it had been for Reds making their way through to this stage of the competition. Junbuk are obviously the powerhouse when it comes to South Korean football, so it shaped as a massive test for Reds. And as we'll work our way through, not quite blow by blow, but yeah, obviously a lot of incidents throughout the game. Yeah, Junbuk certainly gave Reds a very, very stern test, didn't they?
Yeah, I think we have to give Junbuk a lot of credit, because coming into this game, they'd played two matches, two very difficult games, coming through extra time, and I thought they hung in with Reds really well, because Reds obviously started like a house on fire, as they had done in previous games. But yeah, Junbuk, they don't necessarily always look like the greatest team, but they just have that ability to really hang in, and yeah, they cause a lot of problems, especially towards the end, very nearly won it themselves. They will consider themselves unfortunate not to have come away with it, but it shows like it was a real test for Reds, and for Reds to have come through that, I think that proves a few people wrong, because earlier in that campaign, yeah, easier games on paper at least, they've got the home advantage, so everyone was saying, okay, it's quite simple for Reds at the moment, but this was a real test against Junbuk, and they came through very well.
Yeah, I fully agree actually with that. They played a pretty good game, and I did watch actually the two earlier games from them, and I thought this was actually their best one, despite actually being already very tired from two times scoring 420 minutes. But they fought extremely well, and yeah, really were great opponents, and then we just barely made it through. And, in the end, probably even being slightly lucky to manage to get this equalized at the end.
Well, yeah, it was absolutely phenomenal, wasn't it? And well, I really wanted to watch this game live, but I was ultimately overruled and had to sit through a few My Little Pony reruns. But yeah, I was able to catch the game pretty much in full once my kids had gone to bed last Thursday night. And what an epic it was, as I think I've already said three or four times already in this part of the podcast. So for Reds, it's just a shame, isn't it, Ralph, that they didn't carry on that statistical pattern that began with the 6-0 win over Iwata in the final J1 game before you resumed in the ACL, because then it was a 5-0 and a 4-0 as well, wasn't it? But yeah, I guess 3-0 was too much of an ask against Junbuk. But you did make a perfect start with a goal from Yusuke Matsuo in the 11th minute. He met across from Hiroki Sakai, basically directly in front of the goal, and could not miss. I wonder if there's a new folk hero at Saitama Stadium now, Ralph. Maybe that ball boy that gave the ball quickly to David Moberg. He certainly got a high five from Ricardo Rodriguez once the celebrations had died down. He's obviously too young for us to, everybody to buy him a beer, but I don't know. He looks like he's going to be the most popular ball boy around the scene at Saitama Stadium from now on.
This was really much appreciated by the ball boy. But it hasn't really been the first time that this happened. We had actually a few times, I think, this season, a quick reaction by ball boys, which ended in goals, basically. So they do their job really well, and we are very, very happy about them, of course.
Well, in the spirit of fair play, did you notice if they were throwing the ball quickly out to the Junbuk players as well, Ralph, or was that just for the Urawa contingent?
I think they're generally quite quick, but there were a few cases where really they managed to get the ball to our players really, really soon, and then they could really then create chances from that.
Yeah, so Sam, obviously, as you said yourself, Reds had blown the doors basically off their previous two ACL opponents. So once they'd gotten that early goal through Matsuo, I don't know, was there a sense that Junbuk were shell-shocked perhaps, and that it might not be a rout, but Reds might be able to really put a stamp a foothold in this game?
To a degree, I thought maybe first 15, 20 minutes or so, I thought Reds were really on it and Junbuk were holding on a little bit, but kind of, I don't know if Reds ran out of steam a little bit at the start, but or Junbuk just managed to get into it, because they just weathered that early storm and then really kind of grew into the game as that half went on. I thought, yeah, generally, whereas the other teams that Reds have played, JDT and BG Path, and they just didn't quite live with them, but John Buck managed to wrestle it away from Reds a little bit, wrestled that momentum away, and that's just a sign of how good a team they are. So, yeah, it wasn't, Reds weren't allowed to just win the game in that first half as they had done previously. So, yeah, again, credit to John Buck. I think, as we'll come on to, I think they got a little bit lucky in the way they got back into the game with the penalty. But, yeah, they did run it, really managed to defend pretty well.
Indeed. Yeah. So as the first half went on, Ralph, yeah, how were you feeling about things? Obviously, yeah, John Buck, as we've said, a more, you know, lethal opponent than the two previous rounds of the competition. But yeah, as you said yourself, yeah, they were bound to be feeling their exertions in their previous two games themselves. So yeah, as the first half drew on, how were you feeling on the terraces at Saitama Stadium?
I think most people were still quite tense, actually, because against John Book, one goal is just isn't enough. So you cannot feel safe about that. And I had the feeling that this was the most common feeling, actually, by people around me as well, that everybody kind of hoped for getting another goal. But I agree that actually John Book came into the game rather well towards the second half of the first, and even into the second half also to some extent. If you look at the possession, they actually had more possession for the first half than Urawa did, which really surprised me. And yeah, they did create chances. Of course, mostly they have this rather dangerous counters by the two strikers and the wingers, and that was always dangerous, but nothing really came too dangerously close to Nishikawa, I think. But I think there was one save from him, but otherwise they also stayed relatively far away from our goal.
All right then, and Reds reached the Sheds at halftime 1-0 ahead thanks to that early Matsuo goal. And before we move on with our chat about the rest of this epic encounter, Ralph, how are you feeling about Matsuo up front as the in inverted commas lone striker in obviously at the start of the season? That's not where we would have expected to see him playing. Kasper Juncker, obviously the headline name, and obviously made such a great impact when he joined Reds early on in last season. But it's been something I think we've all had to get used to. But Matsuo has shown his adaptability, and it does appear that the team is clicking at the moment with him up front, and obviously Juncker is able to come on and make a massive impact off the bench.
Yeah, I would agree with that. At the moment, not only Matsuo, but also Koizumi, they together actually play pretty well, particularly up front when we don't have possession. They actually either press hard or at least close the passing lanes for the opponent. And that works really well, and then we get quite a lot of short counters out of it and good chances out of it. Of course, not always as easily as say in the Iwata game where really many of these happened. But still, they create some very nice pressure. I think naturally, of course, Matsuo would normally be more of our left winger, and maybe eventually he will actually go into that role again when Linson is fit again, I would assume. But for now, he's actually doing an excellent job up there, I think.
Yes, indeed. All right then. So the second half kicked off, and as I said, Reds at 1-0 up, and then 7 minutes after the break was one of the more controversial incidents of this year's ACL in any game that we've seen so far. And we saw probably the most indecisive referee any of us have seen in a very long time. He just couldn't make up his mind, could he, even after he'd been over and checked the monitor for a couple of minutes. Very, very much took his time on his stroll back as he was basically making his mind up on his way back onto the pitch what he was going to decide. And ultimately, he, well, I guess he held his ground and stuck with his original decision, much to the dismay of all of the supporters at, well, obviously 95% of the supporters inside the stadium, that Ayumu Ohata's 52nd minute foul stood as a penalty kick. And well, that was I don't know whether I should go to the person who might give us a more biased opinion or not, Sam, but well, let's go to you with the neutral take on whether you thought initially that was a foul, and after the referee had been called over and had so many looks at it, whether he should have reversed his decision or not.
Yeah, I think we'll probably get about the same answer, really, because I didn't think this was a penalty. I could sort of understand why that there was a check on whether maybe Ohata had come through Song Min-kyu or not, but I don't think he did. I think he got round him. I think he hooked the ball away. So I thought this was a really harsh penalty, but I guess the referee has given it and then he's not certain, or clearly not certain when he's checking. So he just kind of sticks to his guns, I suppose, which to a degree is to be applauded. But yeah, I thought this was the wrong decision.
And I imagine you would agree wholeheartedly with that, Ralph.
Not necessarily wholeheartedly. I think, yeah, certainly there was contact. And then the question is, was the contact before or after he hit the ball? He definitely hit the ball as well. I think that's clear. But yeah, I think there are referees who give this penalty and referees who don't. So I think this is really a tight call in either way. And yeah, I can understand that it was given. Of course, I'm not happy with that, but that's how it is. I'm a little bit wondering, though, if he gets the VAR call, wouldn't that indicate that there has been actually some clear and obvious error? Or is this just him that he wanted to actually review it himself?
It could be either way. I mean, we never really know. And without the referees being mic'd up, we don't know what happens. But it could well be that the referee wasn't certain on his own decision and wanted that review. Or it could be that the people in the VAR box decided, no, you've made an error here, come and check it. So, yeah, until they mic up referees, we're kind of at a loss.
Yeah, just like in the J-League. So it's yeah, good to know that things are consistent from domestic play to the continent as well. But, yeah, my two cents. I guess I agree. I could see why it was given, but yeah, I think once he goes over and has a look, he can see that Ohata gets the ball first, or at least at the same time as he. There is contact with the man. So yeah, I agree it was harsh, but yeah, Junbuk didn't mind at all, and Paik Seung-ho slotted home the penalty after a 3-minute delay. Nishikawa guessed the right way, but yeah, Seung-ho fired it underneath his dive to his right, and it was 1-1 with a lot of football left to play. And well, yeah, I mean, we could literally do this kick by kick, but let's zip ahead, if we could, guys, to all of those chances for Reds in the 90th minute and afterwards. Firstly, David Moberg and then Ataru Esaka fired over when well placed, but Esaka's volley was a difficult one to keep down, I suppose. But then the moment that I guess, well, you can tell us, Ralph, but watching it back without knowing the score, I thought at the time was going to prove costly for Reds was that double chance in the 95th minute when Esaka played in Junker, who shot past the keeper. The ball came back off the post and went to Esaka. Quite fortunately, he took a touch and volleyed on target and seemingly in slow motion. Goodness knows how it felt in the stadium. The keeper scrambled back to hack the bouncing ball off the line. Esaka then dragging a shot wide, and that was pretty much it. But, well, I can't imagine your heart being in your mouth any more than that, Ralph.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this was quite exhausting. And then there were, as you said, quite many big chances toward the end of the second half. And then we should have really finished one of those chances. And that has been, of course, been kind of the theme of the year so far, that we create plenty of good chances, but we do not necessarily convert them as often as we should. And yeah, as we see later on, then this almost cost us dearly, of course.
Well, yeah, if we could skip ahead again to Junbuk taking the lead with just 4 minutes left in extra time. So, 11 minutes into the second half of extra time, Reds didn't deal with a Junbuk short corner routine. There were no pressure on the two players out on the Junbuk left, and the ball was driven in low and clipped over Shusaku Nishikawa by Han Kyo-won, or a combination of Han and the Reds defender. And Sam, what a hammer blow this shaped as being for Reds. But as we'll come on to, of course, they didn't let their heads drop, and they obviously still found a way to fight their way back into this game. But that looked like it was the death knell for them, didn't it?
Yeah, it would have been. It would have been really sloppy to have lost the game based on that, because it's really poor defending. Reds have made a habit of, for as long as I can remember, Reds haven't dealt with corners properly. Usually it's balls into the area first. But yeah, no one comes out to this short corner. Yeah, it's a simple goal in the end for Junbuk. And the great thing about it was that Reds responded really well. But yeah, if Rodriguez would have been so furious if this was the way they went out, because yeah, it's schoolboy defending. I can understand tired minds at the 115th minute, but Junbuk were on it, so Reds had no excuse. So yeah, really poor defending, but the response was fantastic.
Yeah, I agree with Sam. This was really pretty poorly done, and I think they even had almost the same kind of routine earlier in the match already, and then somehow still nobody actually looked and saw that there's a second man standing there and waiting for the ball. So they should have reacted much earlier, I think.
But yeah, the Reds players, they did not give up. And what about that equaliser in the 120th minute? Hiroki Sakai won the ball back with a crunching tackle 45 yards from goal, and was then just onside when Moberg played him in down the right. His cross was half cleared. Tomoaki Okubo sliced a volley into the night sky, but fortunately it landed on Takahiro Akimoto's head. He headed on target, and after a tremendous save by the keeper, Junker was on hand to slide in at the near post to send it to penalties. And well, what a roller coaster this entire night was, Ralph. But yeah, from 4 minutes previously to thinking that you were probably on your way out at the literally the last hurdle, to equalize in such a fashion. We all dream about occasions like that as football supporters.
Yeah, absolutely. This was just crazy. I mean, the last 5 minutes, I must say, the stadium and the team actually really cleaned that up and fought back, and basically even the stands, which usually do not stand and then sing on the side on the back stand and the main stands, basically they started clapping to the songs that we were singing, and I think that also helped push the players on quite a bit. Also, I have to say that Sakai was really on fire the whole match. He was, as always, I have to say, fighting really to the exhaustion, and managed to get this ball back and then create this chance. And then actually Junker managing to even get this goal with his right foot, which hasn't happened so often apparently.
Yeah, just remarkable, and what a tremendous fight back from Reds so late on when, as we said, they looked dead and buried after conceding that goal in such disappointing fashion just 4 minutes before that. And Sam, I mean, you just have to give huge plaudits to both teams for the show that they were able to put on and the grandstand finish. But yeah, for Reds, I mean, it's just a continuation of their love affair with this competition. And, nobody can deny them over the course of the 120 minutes that they didn't deserve to take it to penalties.
And no, absolutely. There was no way they deserved to lose this game, I didn't think. And Jerry, as you say, every time Reds are in this situation and late in the ACL, it's always a cracker. They usually always bring their best football for it. And yeah, I just thought the passion, obviously from the stands and on the pitch, I just thought was fantastic. You mentioned Sakai's performance. I can't let this go without mentioning Yoshio Koizumi, because the work he put in as that number 10, but defensively, there is one piece of play, I think it was the second half, where Junbuk have had one of their counters, which is so, they were so dangerous from, but he has run back the length of the pitch to put in an interception. I thought that typified the way that Reds have approached this competition in these last three games and kind of the upturn in their results and performances in the last month or so. I think it's just that work rate, that energy. And yeah, Koizumi, I thought that interception was probably the biggest play of the game, and I think that saved Reds on one occasion. Obviously they were saved again here, but yeah, just that never say die attitude. And I think it does come from the support, and John Buck will probably point to, if this wasn't at Saitama, then maybe the result is different, maybe they don't have that energy, but Reds really used that, and I thought yeah, they were just fantastic energy and passion throughout the game.
And yeah, well said, Sam. And so it went to penalties, and then in the shootout, Shusaku Nishikawa saved Junbuk's first two spot kicks with Urawa's Danish connection, Alex Schultz and Juncker coolly converting theirs. Moberg had his penalty saved, but after Junbuk's captain hit the outside of the post, Ataru Esaka had the honour of firing Reds into February's final. Ralph, you probably would have loved to have been able to play the first leg of the final the following few days, but yes, you have to wait. You have to wait all the way until late February, isn't it, 2023, to play the two-legged 2022 ACL final. Obviously, you're rapt to be there, and I mean, it doesn't matter, I suppose, when it is, but it's a kind of a bit of a momentum killer, isn't it, that that it has to take so long. But I guess another way to look at it is, well, this was the East final, wasn't it? So it felt like a final. It played out like one. So you don't get to lift a trophy, but I mean, the players get to enjoy the glory of, beating the best team from South Korea for one. But also, yeah, as we said, continuing on their success story in this competition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would have been great to actually keep on, keep this momentum into the final. And it's kind of unfortunate that of course the final is going to be basically in the preseason or early season next year, whereas most of the Western teams are in the middle of the season at that time. It's going to be great again, I think. These finals are always in a fantastic atmosphere. I was in the home games in 2019 and 2017 when we won, actually. And this is always quite exciting, and I hope that we can still deliver a good game at that time then.
Do you expect this kind of momentum that you've got from this last three games to be taken on into the rest of the league season, and you've got the Levain Cup as well, or do you worry about maybe a little bit of a burnout now that you've got to this stage, you've got that ACL final in the bank, and this season might just peter out? Kind of, what's the feeling amongst the Red supporters about the final nine league games and the Levain Cup?
In some sense, the ACL is always very special for us, and that's kind of always the goal every year, basically, to be able to compete in the ACL. And while there is, of course, the possibility to actually play next year's ACL after winning it via the group stages, it would still be even better if we managed to just qualify via the league this year. And I'm saying that this is, of course, almost impossible at this point, but I think there's still a slight chance that we can actually make it. We have to play essentially all of the teams above us, and if those go well and if we can keep this momentum, I think there's a chance that we can actually at least get close.
All right. Well, yeah, there's some positivity, and I can understand it after such a terrific occasion and a fantastic performance last Thursday night. Yeah, I mean, it is a mountain to climb. You've got a lot of traffic to climb over, and having played a game more than third placed Kawasaki, you're 11 points behind them, Ralph. But I mean, yeah, it's you never know what can be done in football. We've obviously seen momentum be a huge thing in the J-League over the years, and teams can go on runs of victories. As I say, a lot of traffic to climb over, but yeah, who knows what Reds are capable of. We've spoken so much over the last, year and a half, 2 years about the way that Ricardo Rodriguez has put his squad together, has assembled what looks on paper just about, definitely a top three, top four, squad on paper in J1. So far, I guess, apart from the cups, yeah, the results haven't been probably as you and other Red supporters would have hoped for. A sixth place finished last year, wasn't it? And a slow start to begin this campaign. And as I said, you find yourself ninth in the table at the moment. So I guess it's obviously hard to think too big a picture after such an epic occasion last week. But overall, how do you feel that the club are travelling in terms of the squad they've been able to put together and progress that you've seen under Rodriguez? Obviously, you're a supporter of the manager and you want the club to back him long term. But are you overall satisfied with what he's been able to do through his first season and a half, or a little bit longer than that?
Yeah, I would think so. It's taking a little bit longer, but I think that's kind of expected. I almost think that giving this goal of winning the league this year was probably not a good decision, and then maybe even put unnecessary pressure on so many of the young players that we actually do have. If you look apart from the foreigners, then I think maybe Sakai Nishikawa and most of the key players are actually still rather young, and therefore I think they are still developing. And we play good football. If you look, we are actually currently have the best defense in the league with only 25 goals conceded. So that's what I think Ricardo was working on mostly last year, to actually get the defense shored up, and that works pretty well now. With the offense, I think, as I mentioned before, we create actually plenty of chances, and in almost all of the games this year, we had actually higher expected goals than our opponents, but we don't take these chances, and that's been really the big problem for this whole year. And once the efficiency increases there, I think this should be actually quite a phenomenal team to watch out for.
So obviously we've seen the last four or five games, starting with that 3-0 win against Nagoya, that the firepower is there. You've got the ability to score that. So what do you think changed this? Is like the start of the year, you had that Super Cup against Kawasaki, you looked absolutely fantastic, and now recently the form has upturned, you're looking to get more like that. So was it just the pressure, do you think, that was put on, that was the cause of that start of the season, or do you think there are other factors in play?
I don't think I have a good answer for that. I don't think that too much has actually changed. Maybe there's a little bit more stability in the squad that we have, actually every week now playing. So I think he kind of found his best squad to play, and then a few players around it. And so maybe that has helped to actually create a little bit more stability and give them more confidence where their teammates actually are at different times. So maybe that has helped a lot. But I don't see that there's really too much change overall in the way we play. Maybe they go a little bit more into pockets left and right of the goal, and then have then these back passes, kind of similar to what Kawasaki, especially with Buma, were so famous for. So that happens a little bit more often, maybe, but I don't think there have been really huge changes overall.
Okay, nice. And just one more question. We were speaking last week about, obviously, you've had such success with Matsuo playing up front and Koizumi in behind him, but how would you look to get Juncker into the team? Or do you think he fits into the team in terms of getting the best out of the Reds as a whole? Do you think Juncker, do you think there is a place for Juncker in that first 11?
I think at the moment his speed is, of course, very crucial, and that more helps us actually later in the game, and in particular if we are already ahead and can fall back a little bit more. I think then these long passes to Juncker actually work extremely well. To do that from the start, I think it's possible, but I agree with what you discussed last week with Johnny, that I think that's not necessarily the typical play style that I think Ricardo is aiming for.
All right, then. Yeah, fantastic stuff, Ralph. And by the way, you undersold them a little bit before. It's only 24 goals conceded. So, yes, you're doing even better than you thought. And, yeah, the same goal difference as third place Kawasaki. So, yeah, you've managed to turn things around over the last few weeks and obviously have roared all the way through to the ACL final. So, absolutely brilliant stuff after, being a 13th at the halfway point of the season, Ralph. So, you'll definitely want to start next season a bit better with the ACL final in mind, as you say, with the West Asian nations basically in the middle of their season. So Reds are going to have to hit the ground running at the start of the next campaign. Although as Sam mentioned, you did look so good in the Super Cup at right back at the very start of the season. So next season that might be around the same time, I suppose, as the ACL final. And just one more thing I wanted to check with you. Obviously Nishikawa was the shootout hero. Do you ever stop and wonder what might have happened if there wasn't all that drama about Zion Suzuki's missing COVID test or misreported negative COVID test when he was away on international duty last year? Because it did look like he had become Urawa's number one. Whether he still would be by this point in time, I guess, is up for debate. But Nishikawa is a real redemption story, isn't he? And I know he's obviously a favourite on the terraces at Saitama Stadium and an absolute hero to all Red supporters. But I guess it did appear that there was going to come a time when he was no longer first choice.
It looked like that, and I mean, it's kind of almost a luxury problem that we currently have, because we have really two national team level keepers, and then only one can naturally play. So I think they have this agreement now that maybe Zion actually plays most of the other cup games. We're still in the Van Cup. So I think he maybe plays more of those. And then he also played the group stage at the ACL. I think at the moment they're both actually doing very well. And particularly, I think Nishikawa came really back very strong this year, probably thanks to our new keeper coach, Joan Mille, who really improved both of them quite significantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic stuff. And, obviously Reds are, in inverted commas, a huge club in Japan, and definitely in terms of numbers, the most well-supported. So they are often whipping boys for many, and including us on this podcast, if things don't go well for them. But, we obviously wanted to give the club their due after that epic run to the ACL final. And hoping, Ralph, that you can add the 2022 trophy to the ones from 2007 and 2017 that are already in the trophy cabinet. So thanks very much for joining us, mate. And been tremendous to chat to you for the first time, and relive what it was like to be on the terraces at Saitama Stadium on that famous night. So thanks for joining us, and continued success for Reds for the rest of the season.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
An absolute pleasure. And of course, if you're not already, please follow Ralph on Twitter at AkakiChino11. Ralph is one of the most regular questioners to the podcast, so it's absolutely fantastic for us to catch up with him and, as we say, share in the glory of Reds' trip to the ACL final. So thanks again to Ralph. After a quick hit of music, Sam and I will wrap up the games played on the weekend in J1 Match Day 27. Okay, fantastic to speak to Ralph there for the first time on the podcast, and share in a little bit of Urawa's glory from last Thursday night. Sam, returning to J1 action, there were six games played from match day 27 over the weekend, and some huge ones at both ends of the table.
As every week seems to be at the moment, they're pivotal, aren't they? Some fantastic games, some dreadful refereeing decisions, which we'll get on to. But the table is shaping up. I'd be delighted once the catch-up games have taken place, so we can finally get a real sense of the table, because it's all over the place at the moment. But I think at least two teams have really put their names in the hat to challenge for F. Marinos. Hiroshima, I thought, were fantastic, and Frontale as well. So it's sort of shaping up at the top. The bottom is just as big of a mess as it usually is.
Yeah, no question about that. So we will begin at the top with the two teams that Sam's just mentioned there, Hiroshima and Kawasaki. We'll lead off with the Sun Frecce's visit to Cerezo Osaka on Saturday night. Cerezo was sixth at the beginning of this match day, and they hosted Hiroshima, who had, of course, worked their way up to second in the table on the back of three straight victories. And, just a general run of good form through the last three or four months, basically. And the good times continued to roll for Hiroshima as they took the lead midway through the first half when one wing back crossed for the other. Yoshifumi Kashiwa sending over a ball from the left, and with Ryosuke Yamanaka taking out Tsukasa Morishima in the center, Yusuke Chajima arrived at the back post to head past Kim Jin-hyun. Shortly after, Keisuke Osako made a fine low save at the other end to keep out Hirotaka Tamida's first-time shot, and later saved a header from the same player. So you and Johnny talked about this game last week, Sam. There's obviously a lot on the line for both clubs. Hiroshima's momentum was looking irresistible, but Cerezo had also won three straight heading into this game. So we'll come on to the two goals that wrapped up this game and this victory for San Frecce later on. But overall, over the course of the game, Cerezo will look back on this one with quite a degree of disappointment, I would say.
Yeah, I don't think they really performed quite as well as they have done previously. And they didn't really give them like a good account of themselves. I don't think 3-0 was necessarily like the correct result. I think it was a little bit harsh on Cerezo, a little bit in the way that Hiroshima lost 3-0 to F. Marinos, when I don't think they were outplayed to that degree. But yeah, Cerezo just couldn't quite get things going. They've struggled with injuries throughout this season. Harakawa was out here. Taggart was out again. And they just kind of lacked that firepower. And creativity as well. And they just didn't really hurt Hiroshima. And that Tamada chance you mentioned there was probably as good as it got, really, for Cerezo. I thought Hiroshima were quite comfortable. And they just, even though they had a couple of injuries as well, but they've been able to just contribute those players. We've seen it with Kawamura in recent weeks, and Chajima here really ghosted in at the back post to finish off Kashiwa's cross. So, yeah, it just seemed like the worry was with Hiroshima, have they got the strength in depth? But they've managed to come into it. Whereas Cerezo, they've dealt with injuries for so long, but maybe this was one or two injuries too far.
Yeah, and they were able to welcome back Hiroshi Kiyotake off the bench for the last 15 minutes, and they'll obviously need him back for fit for the remainder of the campaign if they're to maintain a push for the ACL positions. But it just wasn't their night, although there was I guess they had a little bit of luck, Sam, a little bit of fortune, although definitely in our eyes they did. I guess it's open to debate for other people to decide on the event 7 minutes into the second half when Cerezo keeper Kim came racing out of his area and appeared to catch Makoto Mitsuta with an outstretched leg on the leg as the young attacker took the ball past him. And then crazy follow-up to that, as the ball ran free, Tsukasa Morishima tried an audacious shot from out on the touchline that Ryuya Nishio did superbly to head off the line with Kim still well out of the equation. It did look like Kim caught Mitsuta, Sam, and I think he was a very lucky boy to escape a sanction after VAR and the referee had a long look at the incident. And then, for Nishio to head the resulting shot off the line, I guess a double escape there for Cerezo.
Yeah, very much so. It was, first of all, great defending from Nishio, great awareness to see where the ball had gone, see that Morishima is shaping up, gets back on the line, good clearance, and a decent effort from Morishima. But the referee here is atrocious. I think it's a clear foul. I don't see what has been seen live or by the VAR check at the monitor, but it's clear that Mitsuta pushes it past Kim. He's clearly caught on the shin. It goes over. Obviously, Kim's now out of his goal if Mitsuta gets through. I think it's a clear goal-scoring opportunity. Yes, there's a covering defender, but it's only the covering defender. The goal is still a gape. The goalkeeper's out there. I think it should have been a red card. I think it should have been a free kick as it was outside the area. And I have no real idea how the referee came to the conclusion that it wasn't. And he just gives the free kick that he'd originally given, because I checked very closely frame by frame. Does Kim get anywhere near the ball? He doesn't. does Mitsuda leave his leg in to be caught by Kim? No, if anything, it's Kim who stretches his leg out to catch Mitsuda. So this was a clearly wrong decision. I mean, the way this weekend's gone, I've got every VAR decision wrong. So did you see anything that I'm not? Or did you see any reason why this wasn't a foul and a red card?
No, I mean, it's clear as day. I mean, he stretches out his foot, Kim, as Mitsuda goes past him, and he catches him on the shin. Yeah, it's no question at all. I mean, it's outside the box. It's not a penalty, but it's definitely a foul. And as you say, you make the case there that there was a covering defender, but there's no goalkeeper in the equation, of course. So, yes, it's a red card. And, yeah, a qualified referee on the pitch. I mean, you swallow your pride, mate, and look at it and see that you got that wrong, because Kim clearly catches him. It's a dreadful decision. And well, as you've said, yeah, there was a litany of them over the course of the weekend. So that is one that we think the referees have definitely got wrong. A lucky escape for Kim and Cerezo, but Hiroshima then went and wrapped up the 3 points with the two late goals. Mitsuta's low blast was parried by Kim in the 81st minute as those two resumed their duel of sorts. But Taishi Matsumoto was perfectly placed to side foot home the rebound. Matsumoto had spent time at Cerezo last year, but after returning to Hiroshima after that loan ended, that will have been a sweet goal for him. And then after Takumu Kawamura had rattled the bar with a strike from distance for Sanfrecce, right at the death, their new Cypriot striker, Pieros Sotiriou, scored from a close range after an unselfish Mitsuta pass. So, two late assists for everybody's fantasy darling. And, Hiroshima continue to roll. That's a fourth straight win. And they're now a point behind Yokohama F. Marinos, albeit having played three games more, of course. Next, we'll head to Todoroki, where Kashima were the visitors. Antlers were in third place at kickoff, and the hosts Frontale were fourth. Frontale won the reverse fixture back at the end of February 2-0, and they went 2-0 up inside 15 minutes on Saturday night. First, Akihiro Ienaga was pulled to the floor in the area by Diego Pichuca, and Ienaga stepped up himself to score a typically nonchalant penalty into the top corner in the 8th minute. And then 6 minutes later, Yasuto Wakizaka stood over a free kick out on the left 25 yards from goal and drove the ball low across the box and inside Kwonsunte's left-hand post. So, well, I mean, 2-0 inside 15 minutes, Sam, but the Kawasaki didn't really need to do that much at all, did they? I mean, the pullback by Pachuca was definitely a penalty, and then the defending and, Kwon was just static, wasn't he, as he watched Wakizaka's shot, flash across him.
No complaints about this penalty. Good play for Ienaga to get in behind. He's really kicked up a gear, I think, in the last few weeks. Like, Ianaga's one of those players that when he's not on it, because of the way he plays, the kind of language style, it looks like, oh, just not try it, Ianaga, maybe do something. But when he's on it, he just looks class, doesn't he? And, a wonderful penalty into the top corner, and minimal effort, but he made it look very easy. And then, the free kick, it's one of those where it's in that kind of corridor of uncertainty. Nobody from the defence kind of take charge of the situation. They both leave, keeper and defence leave it to each other, and it just nestles in to the bottom corner. So they gave Kawasaki a 2-goal head start, which is just horrendous. They tried to make it a 3-goal head start with that back pass from Izumi straight to Marcinho. So it was a really awful start for Kashima, and they just haven't got going, really. I mean, they got that first win under Daikiwa Masa, but since then they've just kind of stalled. So I don't know necessarily if this managerial change is for the best. And last week Johnny said they could drop as low as sixth. I mean, do you have any arguments with that? Do you see them potentially falling to, you look at Reysol, Cerezo, FC Tokyo even? Do you think there's a real chance that Kashima drop out of this ACL race completely?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a possibility. The way that their season seems to be slowly unraveling. I guess we thought there might have been the new manager bounce once Iwamasa came in. But, I mean, the last couple of games, they don't appear to have kicked on at all after the change of manager. So while it's they've definitely come back to the pack and, having played, I guess the maximum number of games so far with the teams below them, with games in hand, yes, it's definitely looking like a possibility, and they'll have to buck up their ideas in the next few weeks, and obviously hope that the fixture build up for the teams below them ends up costing them any chance of building a momentum over the last couple of months of the season. We mentioned Kwon was a bit static there for the second goal, but then he had to make two big saves in the next 10 minutes to keep Antlers in the game, basically. Yeah, Sam's mentioned that horrendous back pass from Ryuji Izumi that basically played in Marcinho, but Kwon made a close-range save from the Brazilian, and then also made a good save from Joao Schmidt's leaping header. It couldn't have gone much worse for Antlers in the first half, Sam, but they were almost handed a lifeline, or should they have been handed a lifeline right at the start of the second half when Kelhena Borizanto, I'm not really sure what he was playing at, wafting his hands around, but I guess it was inconclusive whether or not he made contact with the ball with an outstretched arm.
Yeah, this is a really difficult one because, he throws his arm out. It comes very close to the ball, and Suzuki right behind him obviously is going to claim handball. He was immediately shouting for it, but they showed two replays and you couldn't tell for certain whether it brushed the arm or not. So whether they had different replays in the VAR booth to really confirm that it didn't hit his hand, I don't know. But on the evidence that I saw, it wasn't conclusive that a wrong decision had been made. So maybe Naborizato got away with one, but I couldn't tell, to be honest. So it didn't change the direction of the ball, but yeah, so who knows? Maybe they got a little bit lucky there, but it was just so difficult to tell.
Yeah, fair enough. So I guess in this occasion, we'll give the officiating crew their credit for not interfering with what appeared to be not a natural piece of play from Naborizato, but yes, not anything untowards anyway. And Antlers got the bit between their teeth, and they did get their foothold in this game 7 minutes after the break when Hayato Nakama glanced a header from Yuta Higuchi's driven cross past Frontale's stand-in keeper Kenta Tanno, who was a little bit busy for the remainder of the game, but apart from Frontale having to deal with a bit of shithousery from Yuma Suzuki in the last few minutes, they did manage to hang on and to actually switch places with Antlers in the table after their 2-1 win. That's their third straight, and it brings them to within 2 points of leaders Yokohama F. Marinos, with both teams having played 24 games. We've just previously mentioned Hiroshima, of course, a point behind F. Marinos, so they are sandwiched in between the two Kanagawa clubs, but of course have played three games more than their fellow top three occupants. Next, we will head to Hitachi Daisam, and FC Tokyo had last weekend off. They were scheduled to play Kobe, of course, but Kobe were in action in the ACL, so that game didn't take place. The previous week, Tokyo had a very, very flat performance against Shimizu after a week off before that, so I didn't know what to expect when Tokyo were the visitors to Kashiwa Reysol on Saturday night. Little did I expect a tennis set first set victory for FC Tokyo, 6-3.
I don't think anyone did. This isn't an FC Tokyo game, is it? It was fantastic. It did actually take a little bit of time to get going, but once that first goal went in, floodgates opened. It was just manic from there on, wasn't it? I think this game had absolutely everything. I think Dalton just was incredible when he came off the bench. I mean, he doesn't always get a start, does he? And didn't hear, but I think he turned the game definitely in Tokyo's favour. But it was just wild defending, some great football. It was just, madness. It was just not an FC Tokyo game. That's the only way I can describe it.
Well, Adalton's managed to be man of the match in 35 minutes off the bench. Absolutely remarkable performance for him. 2 goals and 2 assists. And Yeah, wouldn't you know it? I post transfer deadlined him out of my J League fantasy team once I found out that he wasn't starting on Saturday night. So if anything sums up the second half of my J League fantasy season, then I think that is it. It just was not. It has not been my season. And if you're wondering, listeners, why there hasn't been a recent episode of the J League fantasy show on the J Talk podcast network, well, maybe that's because my season has petered out in a pretty ordinary fashion. But this game was pretty mental, and it was a roller coaster, no question at all. I should say though, Sam, generally for Tokyo, putting aside the fact that they won this game 6-3, I mean the first half especially wasn't obviously as manic as the second. I was really really pleased with it, and I think Tokyo controlled things pretty much from the start. I mean, if you look at the highlights package on DAZN, the first two chances are for Raceol, and that's fair because I think they had the first the first two shots of the game. Tokyo weren't able to really create too much, but they were running the game, and the two goals they got towards the end of the first half were basically, I think, partly related to the fact that they simply wore Kashiwa out throughout that first half. And you could see what Kazuya Konno and Diego Oliveira were trying to do down the right-hand side for Tokyo in the first half. Oftentimes, Konno, might have mishit his pass or sent it a little bit too early. But overall, it was a very satisfying display from Tokyo in that first half. They didn't create an awful lot in terms of chances, but I really appreciated the way that they controlled the ball. And as I say, they pretty much ran proceedings.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think just the way that Sukugawa came in as a holding midfield, obviously you've been playing everyone's favourite Keigo Higashi in that holding role, and he's not really suited to it. I'm not sure what he's suited to be fair. But with Sukugawa there, it allowed a little bit more freedom for Matsuki to get forward. It allowed Higashi he was okay in this game, but it allows everyone just a little bit more freedom. There was some really nice interplay, wasn't there, with Konno, with Diego. I think Watanabe as well, who was always willing. He's maybe not the greatest player ever, but he's always willing to get involved, and he caused plenty of problems. That backline for Kashiwa, it was struggling throughout. I think it wasn't helped by Yuji Takahashi being going off injured. I think that disrupted things. But Tokyo generally controlled things and took advantage of that. So, while it was crazy in the second half and that's where all the plaudits are going to go, I completely agree with you. I thought it was a very measured first half performance. And in the end, you got the goals that performance deserved.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and they did manage to wear Raceol down towards the end of the first half. That Konno to Diego hotline finally bore fruit in the 40th minute. Konno sending an early ball forward, Diego turning his defender inside and out before driving low across the box with Kuryu Matsuki stretching at the far post to poke the ball home, and thankfully not popping his hamstring while doing so. Then it got even better for the visitors on the stroke of halftime with the previously mentioned Koki Sukugawa, who I am a huge rap for, Konno and Ryoma Watanabe combining. And, a very unlikely source, but a terrific finish from a left-back Kashif Bangunagunde. He arrived to drive home low with the outside of his left boot at Masato Sasaki's near post. Kashiwa are out on their feet, and another refereeing / VAR cock up. Let's call it what it is, Sam. As they should have gone down to 10 men before the end of the first half, so they were already 2-0 down when Takumi Kamijima, who, as Sam said, was on as a sub for the injured Yuji Takahashi just past the half hour, brought down Watanabe as the last man 30 yards from goal in a pretty central area. So considering a couple of the red cards we've seen earlier on this season, Sam, this simply beggared belief that it wasn't a straight red from the referee, Mr. Nishimura. We were able to establish that he knows the foul throw law, as he pinged another Raceol sub, Yuki Muto, for one early in the second half. But he clearly doesn't know the last man red card law, Sam. How Kamijima didn't see red, considering, as I say, some of the others we've seen this season. And then for VAR to have a look at it and just go along with the initial decision of a yellow card. I mean, there isn't even a covering defender. He's 5 yards behind the play and 10, 15 yards off to the side. So this is almost as clear as a last man red card, I think, as you're ever going to see. My only conclusion was they felt sorry for Raisol having conceded 2 goals in such quick succession, and they wanted to keep make a game of it in the second half.
I'm saying Nishima referees to his own rule book, and it doesn't really go to, with any laws of the game. He just does whatever he feels is right at the time. He likes to be centre of the attention, I think. But yeah, this was a poor decision. Yeah, he's going into the area. There is a defender sort of around the scene, but he's not going to come across to cut out any eventual shot. I just think maybe it was 2-0 down. It was going towards half time. Kind of wanted just to go in at half time, and that was that. And yeah, maybe felt sorry for them, but I think that was definitely a red card. It should have been, yeah, Kamijima had a sort of terrible game. He eventually got the red card, I suppose, in the end. But yeah, this was, yeah, clear. I think it was a clear last man case. And yeah, I don't understand any refereeing decisions this week, and this was just another one.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously 2-0 up going in at half time, and you know, you expecting your opponent to go down to 10 men. I was thinking, okay, well, Tokyo not wrapped up the game, obviously, but have done enough in this first half to hopefully kick on in the second against a weakened opponent and go on to win it. But of course, in some respects, given a lifeline when they should have been down to 10 men, they were able to stick with 11. And well, they simply had to be better in the second half, Raisol, after that first half performance, and they came out looking a different team. I wondered if the teams hadn't swapped ends, just shirts, at the break, as it was a night and day from the first half. Raisol looking much more threatening, and yeah, they got back into the game through Doddy's 54th minute volley. But pleasing again for me as a Tokyo supporter, whenever they were headed in this game, Tokyo had a response. Straight after the Doddy goal, Albert Pucci made 2 changes, and 3 minutes after Doddy's goal, the two of them combined, in a way, I suppose, as Dialton headed a Yuto Nagatomo cross against the bar, and then Shuto Abe was Johnny on the spot to head in the rebound. So, yes, Pucci's changes paid instant dividends with the first of Adalton's 2 assists. And, yes, Shuto Abe getting a goal and restoring Tokyo's 2-goal advantage. That was cut back to 1 when Douglas scored a lovely diving header just past the hour. But the human bowling ball, Dialton, worked up ahead of steam and drove home superbly from the edge of the box 6 minutes later for 4-2. But wait, there's more, plenty more. Takuma Ominami scored with a tremendous first-time drive to make it 4-3 with 15 minutes left. But, well, Sam, frankly, that goal shouldn't have stood either, should it?
No, they even paused this to show that Douglas was offside as he received it to cross it in, but apparently they didn't look at that. It was just clearly offside. It was another one where I made a fool of myself on Twitter. I just said, this is 100% offside as it happened. No doubt about it. And then it was given. I don't understand anything, to be honest. Yeah, clear offside. It's a good finish by Ominami, but yeah, another poor decision. I don't understand what they're looking at. And yeah, okay, yeah, 4-3, I just have to accept it at that point. Just whatever, what's going on?
Yeah, well, so it looked like we were set for a barnstorming finish, but yes, after Kamijima finally saw red for a second yellow card with 9 minutes left. I don't know, so it just appeared that Kamijima just wasn't in the right mental place to play this game. He was obviously expecting to have a nice evening on the Hitachidai bench, obviously the best seat in the house. And then for Takahashi to get injured and him to be called into action, as I said earlier, just past the half hour, he just wasn't right, was he? And as we said, he should have got sent off just before half time, and he was finally shown that second yellow card late on. And so that basically invited the visitors to go on to ice the game, which they duly did with a first for the club for new Brazilian striker Luiz Felipe. It was a pretty impressive blast from him after running in onto a ball over the top from Dialton, his second assist. And yes, Dialton wrapped up the scoring with a crisp strike to make it 6-3 very, very late on. So Well, yeah, neither of us saw that coming. I don't think anybody did. The highest scoring game in J1 so far this season. Of course, Tokyo have been on the end of some absolute spankings. They've shipped five a couple of times themselves. So to go and score six is, well, yeah, as we said, something that we weren't expecting. But overall, on the run of things, one of those games where, yeah, pretty much everything you hit goes in. But I think they do deserve credit for playing a terrific game pretty much from start to finish. And that saw Tokyo move up from ninth to seventh. But yes, there'll be no talk of a late season ACL push, please. Sam, Raceal then, it's obviously a really difficult one for them to take. As we said, they didn't show up at all in the first half and were pretty much played off their own patch. I guess it hits their ACL chances, but I mean, they're still only, well, I mean, they're still in the hunt. There's no question about that, a point behind Kashima. But yeah, I mean, the teams above them, well, Kashima aside, the top three do look to be, you know, in pretty ominous form. And considering the fixtures in hand that Frontale and F. Marinos have, I guess, well, yeah, sorry, there have been a few times this season where we've questioned whether Raceal's run might be coming to an end. And after a 6-3 defeat, I guess it's natural to raise that again. But every time we've questioned them so far, they've answered the bell. So I guess it would be foolish to write them off at this stage, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm not going to get into that. I'm not going to rule out anyone at the moment. But it does look difficult when you think three games in hand for Marinos and Frontale. You don't really see Raceal catching them. And Hiroshima have just been performing so well. So it is difficult. But at this stage of the season, you always then look, if you're in that fifth, sixth, seventh, sixth, I'll cut it off there. But if you're in those sort of positions, you are looking at the potential of fourth place coming available with the Emperor's Cup. I think there'll be a lot of Sanfrecce Hiroshima fans from a few of those teams hoping that that opens up. So it's not all lost. I think there is still a very decent chance for Raceal. They're getting players back. Douglas coming back, I think, is really important for them. Because as well as Osoya and Muto have played in Douglas's absence, Douglas does have that quality. He scored my favourite type of goal with a diving header here. So, yeah, so it's not out of the question for Raceal. But, yeah, I think any late chances of maybe a title push, I think, have probably been extinguished at this point. But, yeah, the ACL is still very much on for them, and they have continued to prove people wrong all season. So I'm not going to go against them anymore.
No, yeah, completely understand that. All right, so there's basically the teams up towards the top end of the table covered from match day 27. So next we'll turn our attention to, well, yeah, what is shaping as a relegation dogfight for the ages. Basically, well, yeah, I think you guys called it an eight-team scrap last week's episode, Sam. Whether Shimizu have done enough to work their way out of that picture at the moment after their win over Kyoto is well, something that we'll talk about in a moment. But first, we have to give Gamba Osaka their due after they visited Nagoya Grampus and returned home with all 3 points after a 2-0 victory. Their first win in eight in the league, and indeed their first in 2 months. Although, well, the way their goals came about was really interesting, wasn't it, Sam? In the third minute, Kensuke Nagai had a chance to give Grampus the lead, but he undercooked his attempt to lob Masaaki Higashiguchi. Then Gumba went down the other end, and, well, it's fair to say the build-up was far from pretty, but after some pinball wizard and some failed attempts by the Grampus defence to clear, Juan Alano slipped in Patrick, who had fallen to the floor, managed to haul himself up, received Alano's pass, and drove home first time low to Mitch Langerak's left. So an early lead for Gumba. And, well, in the 12th minute, it looked like it had gotten even better for them when Leandro Pereira fired home. But his goal was disallowed after Patrick was a hair offside when Ryotaro Meshino played the ball to him on the edge of the box. And it just wasn't Pereira's night. On the hour, his shot went in at Langerak's right-hand post, well out of reach of the keeper, who didn't even bother to dive. But the ball passed an offside Gumba player who, I guess, half-shaped to stick out a boot to divert it in, but then thought better of it and went nowhere near the ball and was off, basically off to the side, wasn't in Langerak's line of sight at all. But the linesman flagged for offside, and after a three-minute delay, the decision on the field stood. So I guess this joins the ranks of the decisions that we just didn't understand over the course of the weekend, Sam, because, there's no question the Gumba player is in an offside decision, but I don't think there's much argument that he's in any way interfering with Langerak.
No, not at all. He's not interfering there. There's not like there's a Gamba, a Nagoya defender that he's blocking off that could have intercepted. I just think he plays no part in where this ball goes. And I think Nagoya can thank Langerak for his vociferous appeal, because I think he shouted so loudly and was so adamant that he was offside that it kind of shocked the linesman into putting his flag up. And once the flag's up, then you have to say, is it a clear and obvious error that it's not offside? And given to Cow is offside and fairly close, I think that's why it's not overturned. But for me, I don't think he's in any way interfering at all. I think this should have been a goal. And I thought, yeah, Pereira was quite unfortunate here, and it should have been 2-0 to Gamba.
Yes, indeed. All right. So we mentioned that Gamba scored after 3 minutes, but basically their move came at the, well, after a Nagoya chance. And then with 3 minutes left, history kind of repeated from Gamba's opener. Ryota Nagaki's free kick was saved, caught by Masaki Higashiguchi, whose punt upfield was controlled by Musashi Suzuki. And from 30 yards, Suzuki sent a sensational strike, flashing past a desperate Langerak dive and into the net. So a Grampus chance led to a Gumba goal in the third minute, and pretty much the same thing happened with 3 minutes left, Sam. Hiroshi Matsuda has his first win as Gumba boss, a potentially priceless 3 points.
Yeah, very much so. And yeah, the goals, yeah, there was some symmetry to it, but I mean, one was a dodgy, terrible goal. It was an awful goal. And Suzuki's was magnificent. And
yeah,
he needs this, because I think since he came in, he's had a few like half chances. He's snatched at his chances, but to score such a goal, it should give him so much confidence. I imagine he'll be pushing his way into the first team now. I think, yeah, this could be a very good sign for Gamba that they can go on and score goals. Again, I don't think they played particularly appealing football. It was quite direct, it was quite long ballish, but it kind of caused errors. I mean, that first goal, like, Nagoya defence was all over the place because of it. So it worked. I don't think it's pretty, but yeah, they don't matter at the moment, does it, for Gamba? They just need to get points on the board, and this is a crucial victory. And yeah, we said last week 8 teams in it, but I'd like to get your thoughts on Nagoya here. They're what, 8 points clear of Gamba at the moment. Matthias went off injured here. If Matthias is out for any length of time at the end of this season, can you see Nagoya being dragged into this, or do you think they're still safe with the amount of points they've got?
Oh, yeah. Gee, I'll tell you what, you can't lose Matthias, can you? They might need 2 more wins, and then they could consider themselves safe. But, yeah, Ralph was positive about Reds maybe going on a late season run and potentially giving the ACL spots a nudge. For me, they've got too much traffic to climb over. I think there's too many inconsistent teams below Nagoya I'm sure they are worried, but for them to fall all the way down into the bottom three. Yeah, personally, I can't see it, even if Matthias would be out for a lengthy spell. For Gumba, absolutely any 3 points would do. And after such a long winless run, a terrific victory for them. And as you say, Sam, yeah, with Suzuki scoring such a tremendous goal, it's got to do a massive amount for him. And hopefully we'll see him, given a chance to start in the coming week, because that was a terrific goal and showed us all what he is capable of. So Gumba have now pulled up onto the coattails of both Shonan and Kyoto, just a point behind both of those teams. Shonan did not play over the weekend, and Kyoto were, in some respects, unfortunate to lose 1-0 away to Shimizu, who themselves have just simply roared up the table and now sit 11th after this huge win for them. I said Kyoto were potentially unlucky in the 21st minute. They did have the ball in the net at Nihon Daira when Shinpei Fukuoka slid in to volley home a low cross in from the left by Yuki Honda. But the goal was chalked off after VAR suggested the ref come over and check out a handball from Ryogo Yamasaki in an aerial duel earlier in the move. And I mean, we're all a bit unsure about, you know, VAR's remit, Sam, and how far back they can go, you know, when they're looking at things, incidents, etc. It's 10, 15 seconds before the goal is scored, I think. It is in the same passage of play. So I guess I can see why it's given. But, you know, it's unfortunate for Kyoto, isn't it, when the referee did appear to have a good look at the incident in real time, but decided against anything at that time for then Yamazaki to be penalised and for Fukuoka to have his goal chalked off.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because maybe two seasons ago, this had to be ruled out, no doubt about it, because there was a handball that eventually leads to a goal. They've changed that rule now, so it has to be like leading directly to it, so it was like if he handled it down and then scored. So they didn't have to go and check it, so they have to see that this was firstly a deliberate handball, or they gained an advantage out of it. And it's a difficult one, because it hits him kind of half on the sleeve, half on the arm, so it is controlled there, and then they do lead to it. But so much has to happen between it being brought down by Yamasaki and a goal being scored. I think it's slightly harsh. I don't think him handling it necessarily makes a massive amount of difference to where the ball lands. So I can see the frustration from Kyoto, but also it does hit at the end. They do go out and score from it. So, yeah, it's one of those where I wouldn't be complaining massively as a neutral either way that this went. So I think Kyoto will feel hard done to, because generally they played well. And I thought they created a decent chance here that and scored from it. So, and it didn't go their way, but yeah, I think this one, it's not the worst decision from VAR, so I'll accept it as one of the, well, a correct decision this weekend and one of the very few ones.
Yeah, they had to get one right eventually. So, yeah, we'll give them a pass on this one. And then, well, yeah, just before the half hour, Yamasaki slid in to meet a cross from Kosuke Takatomi, but Shuichi Gonda stood strong in the S-Pulse net and made a point-blank save as, Kyoto had the better of, had the ball in the net, obviously, and then that really good chance just before the half hour. But Shimizu had the better of the second half opportunities, and they took a brilliant lead in the 68th minute when at the end of an excellent move, Carlinhos volleyed into space on the left-hand side of the Kyoto box, and Takashi Inui arrived to half-volley a superb strike across Naoto Kami Fukumoto and into the top corner for his first S-Pulse goal since his controversial departure from Cerezo Osaka. Late on, Gonda made a superb save to keep out a crisp Yuta Toyokawa strike. But S-Pulse were able to wrap up the 3 points. And, I said they'd roared up the table. They're 5 unbeaten. And, it seems like ages ago when they were bottom after match day 20. But they've since won 4 of their last 7 to haul themselves up to 11th. 6 points clear of 16th placed Gumba. So, I think we said it a few weeks ago, Sam, when Shonan hauled themselves off the bottom, and they had a good run of results. And I'm not sure they ever reached 11th, but they might have touched 12th, I think, before they've started slowly sliding back down the table and find themselves 15th, having played 25 games. Shimizu will obviously be guarding against a similar thing happening to them after they've hauled themselves up, 7 spots in the table to sit 11th. And the founding member of the S-Pulse bandwagon, you're probably just saying that this was going to bound to happen sooner rather than later. But, we've just seen it happen to Shonan. So Shimizu are going to have to be careful that they don't fall prey to the same kind of phenomenon.
Well, it's definitely possible. I still think there are issues in this S-Pulse team defensively, especially. They can definitely be got at, and Kyoto did manage it, but with a little bit of quality and a bit more luck for Kyoto, they would have probably won this game. The one difference I'd say between Shimizu and for Shonan, I don't think Shonan could win this game. I don't think they've got the quality to produce a goal like Inui did, and I think that's where S-Pulse have it with Inui, with Pikachu, with Thiago Santana, Carlinhos. There are so many players in that team that can pull a rabbit out of the hat, can produce something a bit special, whereas Shonan are relying on Machino, and that's about it. So I think Shimizu will still be able to get points even when not playing particularly well, and that's what they managed here. So I don't want to declare them safe, because that will almost guarantee that they fall and get relegated, but I think they're the of the teams, I'm even going from Nagoya down, I think they're the best set to stay up, because they've got so much firepower, they can fire them their way out of trouble if necessary. And yeah, this was a terrific goal from Inui. I think he's come in, he's done okay, but not really shown anything magnificent at the moment. This was a real flash of quality, a really terrific effort. So yeah, good for him that he's put whatever happened at Cerezo behind him. And I think it's generally worked out well for everyone. He's settled at a new club, they're playing well. Cerezo have done fine without him. So yeah, all's well that ends well, and we may never know what exactly went on there.
Yes, yes indeed. All right, well, yeah, just to jump ahead a little bit, we're back to a full 9-game slate for match day 28 coming up this weekend. And I don't want to steal your thunder for Sam's pick of the weekend, mate, but yeah, a certain game at the Edion Stadium between two of your favourites this season, Hiroshima and Shimizu, might just about be getting top billing, I think. But I tell you what, you know, I backed Pikachu in a couple of weeks ago. I thought the 100,000 volts were going to come good with his first J1 goal. And thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, he didn't get it in last week's episode. I thought I might have been a week too soon, but it's just not quite going for him, is it? Yeah, I mean, there are obviously some terrific attacking weapons in the Espol squad these days. But yeah, it's just not quite gone for him, has it?
No, he's trying so hard. He's involved in pretty much everything, and it's just the end finish just isn't working. I need to go back and watch Pokemon to really get a good joke lined up for next week, if that's what your son is after. So I'll try and work on that. But yeah, I just think it'll eventually come for him. He's involved in so much, and yeah, it's only a matter of time before one of these goes in. But yeah, I just think generally he's just increased the quality, hasn't he, of that Shimizu team, and across that line they work so well together. If it's not happening for Pikachu, it's going to happen for one of the others. So yeah, it's working well, and I'm sure the goal will come, and yeah, we can get those t-shirts printed and Espel can have a field day with some merchandise.
Yeah, terrific stuff. Well, should we do our weekly worrying about Kyoto segment? They've obviously, the stats just keep getting worse and worse, don't they? They've won only one of their last nine since the league resumed from the international break in mid-June. In that period of time, they've slipped from 9th to 14th. And as I said earlier, they now just sit a point ahead of Gumba, although they albeit they've played a game fewer. So, yeah, I think you flagged it, you know, earlier than, you know, I would have set the warning signs racing. It does look pretty grim. Obviously, Peter Otaka wasn't available to them over the weekend. And yeah, just it's looking very, very grim, isn't it?
Yeah, they've gone through a really tough run of form, obviously. Then they had the COVID issues. I think they're still dealing with the backlog of that. Otaka was missing, Kawasaki only fit enough really for the bench. They had injuries to Ogiwara. They brought in a couple of Brazilians. Neither were available for this game. So, yeah, things aren't quite going for them. The one area of positivity I do have is if Utaka's back. And this Paulinho comes in from America Mineiro, who generated a pretty decent Brazilian team. He was playing fairly regularly for them. He looks like a player of quality. So if they can just get him fit, then add him to Otaka, I think there's a real chance for a decent attacking outlet there. But it's just whether they can or not, because he's come obviously mid-season in Brazil, mid-season obviously in Japan as well. He's had a few fitness concerns. So, yeah, it's just whether they can manage him to really produce that outlet, because without Otaka, they just look fairly toothless in front of goal. And when it does go in, it's not awarded for them. So, yeah, it's tough for them at the moment. But I thought there were decent signs in this game. I thought for the large majority, especially in the first half, I thought they were the better side. So if they can just keep solid defensively, I think they've got the best manager for the job in the situation that they are in. And maybe he can be that factor that keeps their head afloat, or just in 16th, because even if you're 16th, it's so weighted in favour of the J1 team, you're almost certain to stay up in that situation. Well, at least everyone has so far. So I don't think it's all over for Kyoto, but I think if you were to ask me who are the three weakest sides, Kyoto would be one of them.
Yeah, it's looking that way, isn't it? I mean, they do have the good defensive numbers to fall back on. It's just a matter of getting back Utaka back to goal scoring form, or yes, getting more goals spread across the team. And if they can get that new striker fit, then that could go a long way to securing the goals that could keep them in J1 next season. Another team, obviously, down in the relegation dogfight with a very sturdy defence are Avispa Fukuoka, and they kicked off the match day with a visit to the real estate agent in front of the Station Stadium last Friday night to take on Sagan Tosu. And, this was a very interesting game, and one basically that unfortunately set the tone for the rest of the weekend. First things first, though, my boy Fuchi Honda, who had sliced an early volley onto the roof of the net, then raced onto a through ball from Taisei Miyashiro and slotted home through Takumi Nagaishi's legs in the 17th minute to give host Sagan that early lead. Then 6 minutes later, the poor refereeing and varring across the weekend trend began when Wanma bundled in at the second attempt for Fukuoka after Park Il-gyu had saved his point-blank header from a Jordy Crooks free kick, only for the goal to be ruled out for a phantom offside against Daiki Mia in the centre as Crooks delivered his set piece. Sam, this a really disappointing decision overall, and as I said, it just set the tone for the rest of us to scratch our heads for the rest of the weekend.
Mia is fractionally offside, but he doesn't need to get involved in the play. He's not the one that heads it on. It comes to Wanma. And I think it's been ruled out because they're claiming that Mia is blocking off Huang, but I don't think he is at all. I mean, Huang barely goes for it. It's so high, he's never going to get a head on it anyway. So I think he's a non-factor in it. I think Mia's a non-factor in it. Wanma's clearly onside and scores his goal. So, yeah, I think this was another dreadful decision from the VAR. Thankfully, Avispa scored almost immediately, so it didn't matter too much. But yeah, really poor officiating once again. And it's going to be a packed episode of the J-League Judge Replay, I think, this week.
Yes, indeed. They'll have to go into extra time, to handle all these decisions, I think. And, the tone was set, as you said, for the rest of the weekend. But, yes, thankfully, Fukuoka shrugged off that disappointment of having what looked to be a perfectly legitimate goal wiped away by scoring just 3 minutes later. And it was Crooks and Wanma involved again, but this time it was Wanma who was the provider. He provided a neat layoff, and Crooks finished first time with aplomb across park. So I guess the rest of this game kind of just happened, Sam. For Fukuoka, I guess it's a point away from home, so at the end of the day, they can accept that and move on.
It's stopped the rot, I suppose. They didn't lose this game, and it could easily have happened against Tosu. They didn't really go for it in the end, did Avispa? I spent most of the second half just thinking, well, it's time for John Mary, isn't it? It's time for John Mary, and he got 8 minutes. So, yeah, that's going to be a continuing theme for the rest of this season while I'm moaning about him not playing. But, maybe he's being saved for the midweek game, and he's going to be unleashed on Gamba Osaka. But, yeah, it was just it just petered out, didn't it? It wasn't a great game, but they'll take the point. It's a difficult place to go, Tosu. They generally play very well. So, yeah, good for them. Avispa, maybe if they can get a win in midweek, that puts them in a nice, comfortable position. But without that, yeah, especially if Gamba win, they equal points with Avispa, and it could be a very worrying time. So, big game in midweek.
It is indeed. And yes, we'll move on then to look ahead to the coming days in J1. So, yeah, there's two games on Wednesday night that will be made up after COVID postponements earlier on earlier on in the season, in the last few weeks, Kawasaki will host Tosu in their rearranged game for match day 20. And yes, the game that Sam's just referenced, Fukuoka host Gamba Osaka in a game from match day 24 that had to be postponed a few weeks ago. So yeah, that is a huge one in the dogfight, no question. As Sam says, yeah, if Gamba win, they will go level on points with Avispa, but Fukuoka could go a long way towards securing their safety if they can taste victory at the best Denki Stadium. Then, as I said earlier, we're back to a full slate for match day 28 that kicks off on Friday night with Sapporo hosting Cerezo Osaka, and with the other eight games all on Saturday. And, I didn't want to preempt you by suggesting Hiroshima Shimizu. I know it's a matchup of two of your favourites from this season, Sam, but there are some definitely some tasty ones on the slate, a couple of derbies to boot. So what is Sam's pick of the weekend?
Sam's pick of the weekend.
Oh, it's such a tough one. There are some. I think it has to be Hiroshima versus Espoo. I think just for, again, both ends of the table, both teams in very good form. It should be a really interesting clash of styles. I think, yeah, that's a really exciting one to go for. But, I mean, all across the, like, I think Shonan versus Kawasaki, I mean, can we have a repeat of the reverse fixture where Shonan won 4-0?
Yeah.
I mean, it's perfect time to get that sort of result and see where Kawasaki are after midweek. They could be top going into this one, and that puts a lot of pressure on F. Marinos, who are back in action against FC Tokyo. Obviously, they've had previously very good results against FC Tokyo, but they're not necessarily against an FC Tokyo team playing as well as they did against Kashua. So that proves to be a fascinating game. Obviously, F. Marinos had a poor August, going out of a couple of competitions, not winning a game in that time. They have to bounce back. So that's a really intriguing one. You might want to watch it behind the sofa, Ben. I'm not sure, but yeah, it should be really exciting. So those three, I think, are all interesting. But I mean, yeah, you could take your pick out of anyone. Is there anything of the other games that you might have your eye on?
Yes, of course, we've spoken to Ralph for the first time tonight, so he will definitely be all over the clash of traditional rivals, Kashima versus Urawa, up at the Kashima Soccer Stadium in the game that kicks off the Saturday slate at 6 o'clock. That's, always an interesting affair between those two. And, well, how about the Kansai Derby that also serves as a relegation dogfight six-pointer when Kyoto host Kobe at 7 o'clock on Saturday night. That looks tremendous as well. So a couple of derbies. FC Tokyo Yokohama kind of doubles as a Kanto derby, I suppose. They're different prefectures, but bordering each other. And if that's going to be 6-3, I'm pretty sure I know which way it's going to go, and I won't like it. But it should be entertaining for sure. If Tokyo put in any sort of a performance, they'll look to match F. Marinos, who will be refreshed, and they'll be looking to kickstart their last 10 or 11 games of the season, when, of course, they made hay in 2019, ultimately ending up with the title. So, yeah, promises to be a fantastic match day back in business, and looking forward to rounding it all up with you on next week's episode.
Yeah, great to have you back, first and foremost, for this episode. Great to have you back in the hosting chair and taking all the pressure off me. Great to have Ralph on, and I look forward to wrapping what looks to be a fantastic match day with you next week.
Yes, thanks, mate. Hopefully it doesn't disappoint and it turned into a bit of a wet fish. But yeah, I think all of these fixtures look tremendous. So we're bound to have plenty more action to report on this next week's episode. So that is it for this episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Ralph again very much for his time on this week's episode. And again, if you're not already, please follow Ralph on Twitter at AkakiChino11. Thanks to all of our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. And of course, listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to review J1 Match Day 28. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.